Welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Muller. Today we're talking books, and joining me in the studio is Sarah Shaffy, online editor at The Bookseller. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Later on in the programme, we will be discussing Margaret Atwood's take on Shakespeare's The Tempest. But first, we're starting with two American road trips, or at least I assume they're by road, because you don't see all that much from the air. The first of which is Another Day in the Death of America by the writer and broadcaster Gary Young. And now, he's starting with the fact that on an average day in the US, seven children and teenagers will be shot dead. And he picks on one particular day, 23rd of November 2013.
Yeah, he picked a random day, and the premise of the book is that he will try and tell the stories of all the children that died on that day via gunshot wounds. So he happens to find 10 who were killed on the 23rd of November 2013.
Now, the self-evident premise of his book is that, depressingly enough, there isn't a shortage of material. There was nothing significant about the 23rd of November. He could have picked the 22nd or the 24th, and it would have been much the same.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing here is all of his victims happen to be boys. There are no girls killed on that day. But, I mean, like you say, another day, it could have been another 10 children. I don't think there would have been much difference. I think the youngest victim he looks at here is 9. And I think in the book he talks about how on one of the days he looked at, and this came out of a piece he did, I think, for The Guardian, following a similar premise. And on that day, the youngest child who died by a gunshot wound was 2. So there's slight differentials, but not that much.
And Gary Young, we should note, is a British reporter who has spent a long time in the United States. He wrote a book I enjoyed very much a few years ago called, if I've got the title right, There's No Place Like Home, or something very, very like that. And that was kind of an American road trip stroke autobiography. It was quite a self-deprecating autobiography, talking about how he, as a black kid growing up in otherwise aggressively normal Stevenage, had kind of given himself an identity by sort of identifying, I guess, vicariously with the civil rights struggle in the US, and on that basis trying to understand America. Does he, apart from the obvious fact in this one that America has a problem with guns, does he come to any other conclusions as the British man in the United States?
No, I think he tried not to put too much of himself in this book. I think he says very near the beginning that this isn't a book about gun control, although obviously it's a book about the effect that the availability of guns has in America. His aim was very much to tell the story of the lives of the children who died rather than about their deaths. So there's not much judgment there. There's not much of himself in there apart from what he went and what he saw and what he spoke to family members or friends about and what he observed, or in some cases didn't observe, because some of these stories aren't as fully formed as others. Some of these kids didn't have family members that wanted to speak, or friends that wanted to speak, or Facebook tribute groups or anything like that.
Well, this was my next question about how he got on in terms of getting that kind of access to people. I mean, I know from having worked as a reporter in the United States myself that it's easier than a lot of countries, because frankly, you can't shut people up really, especially once they hear a foreign accent. They will tell you stuff that, you know, any non-American wouldn't tell their best friends. But this is obviously a difficult and sensitive area. How does he go with getting that kind of access to people?
Yes, I mean, there's a lot of doggedness involved. So he, obviously the internet is a great resource, because a lot of people nowadays do leave kind of tributes online, and the ages of the children that he's looking at. I mean, I think kids have a social media presence from a very young age nowadays. But it's about contacting funeral directors after he saw who organised the funeral. It's about talking to the reporters at the local newspapers who might have a contact detail. But very often he started with a very tiny piece of information and then went and found somebody who could help him. And some of the families were exactly as you said. They just really wanted to talk about this person in their lives who had passed away, and others, nothing, absolutely no contact at all. And all he was able to put together was kind of things that he'd surmised about the neighbourhood, and kind of the, perhaps in some of the stories, some of the gangs that were involved and the history of them.
Do you get a sense of who he was writing the book for? Because at one level, if you're a non-American writing about America and guns for a non-American audience, it's quite easy, I guess, to get an emotional, if not outright sanctimonious, response from a foreign audience. The rest of the world I think the rest of the world enjoys thinking it knows better than America whenever it gets an opportunity. But guns is, I think it's the one area which the rest, almost all of the rest of the planet, looks at America with complete bafflement. Does he play to that gallery, or do you get the sense that he's actually hoping Americans might read this as well?
I'm not really sure. I think, obviously, he is a, well, at the time he was a foreigner in America, and I think it is a book for people outside of America. Because it's not about gun control directly, it does offer a slightly different perspective, because I think, like you say, we'll often see a story about something terrible that's happened in America, and the first response will always be, you know, and I've done it, oh, if they had better gun control laws, of course this wouldn't have happened. So this is about kind of the human effect of that, and I think it still is for a largely foreign audience. I don't know what an American audience would think. I think those people who want greater gun control would be totally on board, and I don't think it would have any effect on the NRA or any of their supporters, really.
Regrettably not. That is Another Day in the Death of America by Gary Young. It's out now, published by Nation Books. We should look ahead now to some forthcoming releases in October. We'll start with The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. It's an adventure, I guess, of sorts, following Cora, a slave in Georgia on the brink of womanhood, and she's been outcast by other slaves when she meets another slave, Caesar, who is also attempting to escape from Virginia. The Underground Railroad, of course, being the apparatus by which slaves were spirited from the South to the North prior to and during the Civil War.
Yeah, I think it's a really simple and quite ingenious concept in a way. This novel turns that Underground Railroad, that network of abolitionists, of safe houses, into an actual underground railway. We don't spend a lot of time kind of travelling on the trains under the ground, but it's key to the story of how Cora and Caesar move from one state to another in their pursuit of freedom.
So is it historical fiction as such, or is there an element of, I don't know if magic realism is the technically correct term, but you know what I'm saying going
yeah.
on here.
I think there is a slight element of magical realism, but there's a lot of factual history that's used to inform this novel, and there's lots that I don't really want to talk about in too much detail because I think it spoils the impact of the novel. But there's quite a few incidents that I had no idea had happened, and I think they're a part of American history that is completely hidden, that Colson Whitehead really explores, and they're jaw-dropping, really. So yes, there's some magical realism in there. Obviously, the Underground Railroad didn't exist. It couldn't have existed. And as Cora travels from place to place, you kind of go through, I guess, a lapse in time that is a bit magical, but it is rooted in reality.
I mean, I'm just wondering, do you think it's reflective of a trend I think we've seen recently in a couple of, you know, obviously well-known movies as well, that there's an examination of slavery, which is a phenomenon that everybody knows about and everyone knows it happened, and almost no sane or serious person thinks it was anything other than reprehensible and regrettable, but it is just regarded as a, as you say, a big amorphous thing. The kind of individual stories and incidents of, as you say, astonishing horror that occurred under that definition do rather get forgotten.
Mm. And I think, like you say, I mean, I think 12 Years a Slave, the film, springs to mind, and there are a lot of slave narratives out there. I think they're still really important to read, especially because America is still grappling, I think, with racism and with kind of class. And a lot of that comes from the history of slavery in the country. So, yeah, I think it's important. I think it's a good book as well. I think it's one of the best books I've read this year, if not the best book. So While it's important to read these things and to acknowledge that this terrible thing happened, this is, at the end of the day, a good book as well that I think people will like reading, even though it's very tough in parts.
Okay, well, that's obviously high praise right there from somebody who obviously reads a lot of books. But if you're saying it, it's one of your favourite books of the year. What did you specifically like about it?
I think in one way, it was the fact that Colson Whitehead never exploits his subject matter. Terrible things happen to Cora, but we're never kind of told about them in gratuitous detail. There's never a kind of any exploitation of her as a character. And I think that was just so stunning. And I think that's what made it a real punch in the gut at times. I think it's a book that really makes you feel.
Okay, well, that's The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead. It's out on October the 6th, published by Doubleday Books, and fairly unreservedly recommended there. We should move along finally to The Hagseed by Margaret Atwood. The past year, I guess, indeed the past few centuries, have seen plenty of reworked Shakespeare texts, thinking of Jeanette Winterson's retelling of A Winter's Tale and Tyler's version of The Taming of the Shrew. The publisher behind this series is Hogarth. The latest edition is Atwood's contribution, Hagseed. This is her view of The Tempest. We should talk a bit about that series so far. I mean, it is adapting Shakespeare is something people have been doing in every medium imaginable now forever and ever and ever. And you know, quite rightly, I guess, it is the Rosetta Stone of English literature. Has there been anything distinctive about this series?
I guess the thing with this series is that it's taking well-known, well-respected writers and asking them to rewrite or bring a new take to a story that's probably influenced them in their writing career. I think there's a rare writer that you can speak to who hasn't been influenced by Shakespeare in some way or another,
it would be like meeting a modern British pop musician who claims not to have been influenced by the Beatles. They would just be trying to start a fight.
Yeah. And I think what's great about this is that it's a real challenge to write Shakespeare well, because there's nothing wrong with a lot of these plays that they're retelling. I think
not a great deal.
I think they stand, you know, they kind of, I mean, they might, the costumes might not be modern, but they stand the test of time in a lot of ways. So to be able to retell a Shakespeare play well is a huge challenge.
So how does Margaret Atwood go about that with The Tempest? Because as you correctly point out, it is a daunting thing to do, sitting down with a Shakespeare text and thinking, well, what can I add?
Yeah, how can I do it better? So Atwood kind of takes the point of view of it's almost a story within a story. So she sets it in a community in Canada, and you've got a spurned kind of theatre director who takes himself off and isolates himself for 10, 12 years until he can get revenge on the people who wronged him. So there's obvious parallels there with the themes of The Tempest. And then within that, this theatre director is putting on a version of The Tempest in a prison that he works in with the prisoners there.
So the theatre director is putting on his own. I see what she's done there, I think. Does that work? I mean, obviously, there might be, I might be reading too much into this. Is there a homage there, do you think, to Shakespeare's own habit of writing plays within plays, which he did more than once as well?
Yeah, there might be. And I think the great thing about the setting that she's given is that it enables her to update or use modern parallels for a lot of the things that Shakespeare did. So technology is an obvious stand-in for the magic that's used in The Tempest. So, you know, the prisoners are making up their own rap songs and using current music and computer programs to put things together, and everything's done because it's a prison and you can't have all the prisoners, you know, 1,000 of them watching their fellow inmates put on a play. It's all done via video. So there's a lot of kind of trickery involved that I suppose if Shakespeare was writing now, he might be writing for film and using kind of CGI and technology in that way.
Basically, though, I guess the question is, does it work? Because I suspect most people listening to this at some time or another will have experienced in some medium or another an attempt to update Shakespeare, which has been wonderful and extraordinary and has tapped into the original spirit, brought it into the modern day, etc., and will also have sat through the same thing, which has been I'm judging by your expression, you've been victim to more than one or two of these.
Which
has been an unmitigated catastrophe. On that spectrum, where does this fall in?
I was really happy to find that this falls on the good end. Margaret Atwood, you know, she's a great writer anyway, and I was very relieved to discover that this is a really entertaining kind of retelling of The Tempest, as well as being, you know, well written and all that kind of thing. It's just fun to read.
Well, that was my next question, because I think there is a tendency, and it's understandable when modern authors, you know, approach the Bard to treat them like they are museum exhibits, that they have to be sort of very gently handled. I think it requires real confidence to decide, you know what, I'm going to have some fun with this.
Yeah, and I think it's great that Margaret Atwood has that confidence, and that it's not just a straight retelling of The Tempest dumped in modern times, that she's clever about it and that she has some fun with the conventions that Shakespeare created.
Okay, well, that's The Hagseed by Margaret Atwood. It's out on October the 6th, published by Hogarth, and other books in that series are already available. And that brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to my guest, Sarah Shaffy. You have been listening to The Monocle Arts Review with me, Andrew Muller. The producer was Holly Fisher. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Join us again at the same time tomorrow. We'll be rounding off the week with a look at the latest movie releases. But for now, thanks for listening, and goodbye.